Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. We've all been looking for new approaches for dealing with homelessness. And Republican Senator Phil Fortunato had put into the budget a housing supply and affordability task force. He wanted to gather some objective information about how to deal with the problem. That was vetoed by the governor. So I asked Senator Fortunato to come into the studio and talk to us about that. He says what he's been trying to do is reduce the cost of housing by reducing the fees and requirements imposed by the government.
Well, the problem that we have is we have a lot of anecdotal evidence on stuff, a lot of stories. For example, people come to me and say, you know, I worked for the King County Housing Authority and they had a program that spent $2 million and housed one person. You know, we have industry studies where the you know, BIAW, for example, comes out with a study and says, look, this is the cost of government. This is what the government adds to the cost of housing. Well, but, you know, elected people don't sort of take that because it's an industry study. So, okay, well, then let's do a government study. Let's have the government actually look at what does the government do to cause the cost, the increase the cost of housing.
So you wanted some objective information on how to make it cheaper to build housing.
Well, I mean, we have all kinds of stuff that adds. I'm on the housing committee, which was the reason for this. I'm a little frustrated because we're saying, look, the government causes this. We want to address that. Well, how do we know? That's not true. We have these other programs, blah, blah, blah. We spend a ridiculous amount of money on these housing programs, but are they working? Heck, I don't know. I mean, you have any idea how much money we spend on homelessness? This is the state programs and the counties. We spend $2.7 billion with the B dollars.
Every year?
Biennium. That was okay, biennium. And that number is a couple of years old. And that does not include cities. So in addition to that, if you added cities, Seattle and all the other cities, for example, you'd be over $4 billion.
Do you know what that comes down to per homeless person?
It was ridiculous, like $240,000 a homeless person. Well, I mean, you could write them all a check and say, hey, don't come back.
Have you figured out why? Why it costs so much?
Well, I mean, look at the programs that you're doing. What do you say to somebody that I had a program called the Shelter Act, right? Mm-hmm. I said, the purpose of this bill is not to end homelessness. The purpose of this bill is to get people off the city streets and out of the parks. That's all. It says, fine, you know, Martin versus Boise said, you can't get them off the street unless there's a place for them to go. Right. Fine, I'll give you a place to go, give you a tent, give you a sleep bag, social services, drug and alcohol treatment. Now, after we do this, and then I made the mistake of saying police presence instead of security, 437 people testified opposed to that bill, which, by the way, is currently being implemented throughout the state through different cities and stuff. City of Tacoma, for example, in November, I think, they were on TV about their innovative approach. We're going to fence an area in. We're going to give them a tent. We're going to give them a sleep bag. So, I mean, it's exactly my bill is being implemented. And then I said, if you then camp on public property, it's a misdemeanor. You're going to go to jail. And now you're criminalizing homelessness. Well, various cities and all that stuff, they said, fine, if you camp on public property, $1,000 fine, 90 days in jail. $1,000 fine, 30 days in jail. Tacoma was $250 fine, 30 days in jail. So they're implementing my bill. Mm-hmm. So, but what do you say when you go and you say to, you know, I want to get a hearing for my bill and no drugs, no alcohol at these facilities. So if I, at taxpayer expense, of providing this temporary shelter, mm-hmm. no drugs, no alcohol. And the response I got back was there's no evidence that denying them drugs and alcohol helps them. Now, I stood there a little bit shocked and I said, but there's plenty of evidence that says if you allow them to continue on drugs and alcohol, it hurts them.
Yeah.
I mean, now when you're dealing with this logic, example, the housing first model works. Mm-hmm. Okay. Housing first is you provide housing for them. You provide that stability and all that stuff and on and on. And everything is going to work out great.
No judgment of their use of alcohol.
Right, right. So we're not going to tell you can't have drugs and alcohol. Yeah. Some programs do, by the way. But I think the number that I saw was a 12% success rate. Now, that 12% success rate happens to coincide with the people that I would describe as down and outers. Now, these are people that a series of bad things happened. And, you know, they lost their job, their car broke down, whatever it is. They don't want to be poor. They don't want to be homeless. They don't want to be sleeping in their car. They might have a minimum wage job. Those people need a little bit of help.
And those are the people that he thinks we should be focusing on. We're going to have more from Senator Phil Fortunato on the housing crisis at 8:15 this morning on Seattle's Morning News. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. And today, one of the higher profile characters in the January 6th attack is facing sentencing. Let's go to CBS consultant and law professor Thane Rosenbaum. This is Richard Barrett, the 62-year-old bearded man from Arkansas in the baseball cap who posed with his boot on Nancy Pelosi's desk. What does he face?
It's hard to tell whether he seemed harmless or crazy. You know, look, it's important to remember that 1,000 people were arrested on January 6th. There were, I guess, 32,000 people at the Ellipse. Only 1,000 ventured to the Capitol. Of the 1,000 people who were arrested and detained and convicted or pled a deal, you know, the vast majority of them pled guilty to the very things that you're going to see today, things that are equivalent to the destruction of federal property, unlawful entering of a government building, interfering with a government meeting in progress. And those, the vast majority of people have received those kinds of sentences. Mixed in with that this week will be the sentencing of 9 oath keepers, 6 of whom were convicted of seditious conspiracy. So your listeners should always know the word seditious conspiracy, which was really only applied to about 1,000 people, combination of oath keepers and Proud Boys. And by the way, of the 9 oath keepers, only 6 of the 9 are receiving seditious conspiracy. You know, it's not to minimize the offense of the man who was, you know, dressed as a Viking or whatever. It's just to make a clear distinction between those that were engaged in the equivalent of the attempt of overthrowing the federal government, right? Which is what seditious conspiracy is. And seditious conspiracy also includes, although the Proud Boys deny this, that there was a plan. That you all had a meeting and you had a plan, and this is what you plan to do. It's important to know that the Oath Keepers said, no, we didn't have a plan. It was spontaneous, improvisational, and even the text messages we sent to each other was like frat boys trash talking. We didn't really know what we were doing. We were caught up in the moment.
Well, yeah, Barnett's defense was essentially, I'm not a domestic terrorist, or I guess his lawyer said, he's not a domestic terrorist, he's everyone's crazy redneck uncle. So he was just swept up in this.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you're saying, well, look, unless you have video of me smashing windows, which I don't think is what they had, you know, that's another thing, right, that if someone smashed the windows and unlawfully entered the buildings, and then you ventured in after them, not breaking any of the property, and then just walking around and putting your feet up on a desk. Now, again, these are crimes. There's just no question. But, you know, I think most Americans weren't able to make the distinctions between, you know, the main charge, which only went to about a dozen people, and the vast majority of people who pleaded guilty or were ended up convicted, who, you know, were still, they should never have been there. Still, these were serious crimes, but they were not the main charge.
Well, so bottom line, should Richard Barnett have the book thrown at him or, you know, a couple months in jail, slap on the wrist, don't do it again?
I don't know the real answer. Throwing the book at them, for in his case, you know, when you listen to them, they all seem like they had, you know, in addition to, you know, bad motives, bad information, bad motives, there was also something that seemed mentally, you know, not fit. You know, why was he dressed like that? right? I mean, nobody really talked about why was he dressed in that manner? You know, was that an indication of what? That he, you know, was some tribesman who was there to, you know, take over the federal government? You know, there was such lunacy associated with it. So I don't know. You know, I know that, like, for instance, what I mentioned before with the Oath Keepers, they're looking at 25 years in jail each. And the one of whom, I think, who for reasons that I'm not sure, they're seeking 10 years in prison. So clearly that's not what we're going to see today. But is this whether months or years? I just don't know. I mean, most of the people who were pled guilty to, you know, there was time served and either 6 months and then a year or a year.
CBS consultant and law professor Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, thanks very much.
Anytime, Dave. Thank you.
If you're wondering where you can find that low-income housing in Seattle that we keep hearing about, I can give you the address. It's the new 17-story building on the corner of Boylston and Madison on First Hill in Seattle, which had its grand opening yesterday. This building includes two projects, The Rise, which is low-income housing for working people, and in the same building, Blake House, which is for homeless elderly people. The project is run jointly by Plymouth Housing and Bellwether Housing and was built on unused land bought years ago by Sound Transit for a light rail station that was scrubbed. Project cost $177.6 million. And I can tell you, because I went to the opening yesterday on the 17th floor, it is definitely a million-dollar view. The question is, will buildings like this visibly change the homeless problem, and is there enough money to build more of them? One of the driving forces behind this project was State Representative and former House Speaker Frank Chopp, who pushed the legislation to secure the land and is working on several similar projects around the city. The key to financing this is that private investors get a federal tax break for raising part of the money, and the land for the project had already been paid for by Sound Transit.
We had an opportunity where we're expanding the transit system to also make sure we take care of other needs, mainly for affordable housing. And that was the key, is to have a willingness to do other things other than just transit.
Because, and this is on Sound Transit land, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was the understanding, is that when Sound Transit is developing stations, they have surplus property afterwards, including the air rights above light rail stations. So that's why we're developing many of these sites across King County, throughout Sound Transit, for affordable housing that's owned and operated by nonprofits and public housing authorities. So we're very excited about this opportunity.
Okay, so you also had some banks. You had private money involved in this. What's in it for them?
Well, that's pretty typical. They provide financing, but they also benefit financially through federal tax credits, too.
So explain the tax credit, because that's key to a project like this, right?
Yes, it's basically the federal system that was set up many decades ago, essentially to provide some funding in the form of tax credits, so that the actual money coming in to help fund this includes banks and other private lenders. And then in exchange for that, they also get a tax credit on some of their other obligations.
So a tax credit on the property tax that's owed on this building?
No, not property tax. It'd be a federal income tax.
So they get an income tax rebate, basically.
Basically.
All right. So that's sort of like public financing that gives the private money a motivation to invest in this?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Now, what is the involvement of the housing nonprofits, Bellwether Housing in Plymouth? What's their role in this?
Well, they play a critical role, because somebody's got to step forward and actually do these projects. Mm-hmm. And it's much better to have nonprofits or public development authorities step forward in public interest to make sure that the housing is built and then it stays affordable for many decades. Mm-hmm. And that's critical, because the rents on these apartments are very affordable.
Who are these apartments designed for?
Well, first and foremost, to help the folks who are chronically homeless on the streets, because they have the greatest need. And they also, not only are they homeless, but they have medical conditions that have been part of their struggles. So that's the first priority. And in this building, there's 112 of those units just for them. In addition, there's another 300 units for what's called workforce housing that are lower wage workers who are doing the work for all of us in downtown or in the various places, whether they're janitors or cooks or whatever, they don't get paid that much, but they need to live close to where they work. And so that those 300 units are reserved for them.
How do you replicate this? Because, I mean, 300 units is great, but you got like, what, 11,000 people looking for homes.
Well, that's why we started the Home and Hope Project, which has 20 major sites in King County already identified for development. About five of those are already completed, including this one here at Bellwether and Plymouth Housing. And those are each unique, and there are huge opportunities to provide a service to the community, not only with the affordable housing, but other things the community needs, ranging from an early learning center or a child care center or a community health clinic. Even one project, which is really sort of interesting, there was a skating rink in Federal Way where Apollo Ono trained, and it the owners were retiring, and we swooped in and bought the property, which and saved the skating rink for the community, which the community loves it, and there's enough land there for about 200 units of housing to be owned and operated by El Centro de la Raza. So we look for opportunities that could combine a number of good community uses.
So how many units like this are we talking about total that are in the pipeline?
Thousands and thousands.
Thousands and thousands. Enough to make a visible difference?
I don't want to overpromise, Dave. I think too many people promise too much. So we're saying thousands. We know that's the case because of the three that we just opened up. That's 800 units of housing, right, in just those three projects that are already complete. But we have more on the road, and you can actually see one right there, over there.
How many more of these are in the pipeline?
Well, our top priority for right now is to deal with the folks who are chronically homeless. And so we are identifying projects all over the state to provide a location for supportive housing where they not only can get off the street, but they can also get some supportive services so they can deal with their mental illness or other kinds of medical problems they have. And that's through a program called Apple Health and Homes, where we recognize that about 70% of the homeless that are chronically that way have a medical condition. So as part of their medical treatment, they have a home, because that's much better than suffering and in some cases dying on the street. It's part of a medical system there that actually responds to their medical condition that is a way of moving forward in a way that the public would understand and would support.
State Representative Frank Chopp. And the building is beautiful. The apartments are small, like 442 square feet, but the building is beautiful, but it's not cheap. So the numbers I got from the project website show the total cost of the building, $177.6 million. If you divide that over the 360 apartments, that comes to about $493,000 per apartment. Now, if as a landlord I wanted to get a 4% return on an investment like that, the rent would be something like $1,644 a month. This is subsidized for low-income residents, so the rents start much lower than that. The rent for a 442-square-foot studio apartment, $1,130 a month, which is pretty affordable for that part of Seattle. In one of the speeches at the opening, we heard the story of a new tenant who had a job as a janitor, been living on the streets, wept for joy when he saw his new apartment because, like I say, they're beautiful. And so the low-income housing is there and more is on the way, but again, it's not cheap. So if you go by the latest homeless count, the latest homeless count I could find said 13,000 homeless people. You would need 35 more buildings like that to house them all. And if they are all costing what this one did, about $177 million, that would be a total investment over a certain number of years of about $6.4 billion. So, not cheap.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Baird. Focus on your financial needs since 1919. A father's love for his daughter inspired a project that now brings joy to thousands of people each year. Gordon Hartman says his daughter Morgan was born with both physical and cognitive disabilities. For years, though, she lacked a diagnosis. One thing she did have, a happy spirit. Her dad, Gordon Hartman, never wanted to see that spirit dulled, but sometimes it was.
We were on a family vacation where I watched Morgan not be able to participate in a pool activity with some three other children, and it was simply because she was not able to be verbal. It almost puts a lump in your throat because it gives you a very sad feeling. that all Morgan wanted to do was to participate. She just wanted to play.
His idea, an inclusive theme park where no one feels left out. He had experience as a builder and enlisted help from other experts to turn his dream into what is now Morgan's Wonderland.
No matter what their condition may be, that's not a question anymore.
Hartman says the San Antonio theme park isn't just for people with disabilities, it's for everyone. But he made sure every single experience and ride is what he calls ultra accessible.
That's the beauty of this place, is that it's an opportunity for everyone to truly enjoy playing together.
The park opened in 2010, is believed to be the only one like it in the world, and it has expanded to a sports center and camp with an outdoor adventure park. Across all the recreation areas that bear her name, there's a Ferris wheel, zip line, and even a water park, all fully accessible.
We have a wheelchair valet. You go from your wheelchair to a wheelchair that's been specially built to the size that you need.
Hartman has seen firsthand how an accessible theme park can change the lives through joy.
I met a couple from Mexico City, and they had never had a chance to, because of their special need, ever a chance to play in water together. They heard about it. They came here. They cried with me and talked to me about how this was the most wonderful opportunity they had ever had.
Morgan's favorite ride, the train, which loops the theme park. She also likes the swing. Morgan's Wonderland has welcomed visitors from dozens of countries and all 50 states, and those with disabilities enter for free.
7:48, Seattle's Morning News, and here from the Gene Ursula Show is G. Scott. So where do you come down on the Amazon mini strike?
They're striking for a couple reasons. One is because of the layoffs, and two, because of the whole not being able to work from home, having to come back. I try to mind my business when it comes to, like, hey, do you, boo? You know what I mean? That's what's going on at Amazon. I'm not mad at folks. If they want to go ahead and stand up for themselves and walk out during their lunch break and let it be known, that's cool. I told everybody on my show that if it was my kids working at Amazon, I told them to tell their superior, hey, boss, I ain't going nowhere. I'll be sitting right here at my desk, because not everybody is judged the same. Now, just because your friends can walk out and do what they do and let their voices be heard, doesn't mean that you can. And so I think this just comes down to leverage. I think every private company has individuals who do not want to come back to work. And when they don't come back to work, it's like this. It's like, well, who are they? Who are they to the company? And if the company can probably say, you know what? If you don't want to come back to work, you're gone. But the company can say, ooh, we kind of need you. Then they let you kind of do what you want. That happens all over the country. And I'm good with that.
So you're not opposed outright to this idea of walking out?
I mean, no. Just be careful. You know what I mean? Like, because, I mean, this is Amazon. This is tech has been getting laid off a lot. Yeah. Just make sure you know. Make sure you cool with your supervisor. Make sure you know that there's not another round of layoffs that are coming, because it might happen. It is it's unfortunate that there are some people that decided to move away. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you used to live in Seattle, and maybe you live now in Bellingham, or maybe you live east of the mountains and you were doing your job remotely from home and you're doing your job efficiently, but they still want you to come back to work. Hey, that's your employer.
I had not thought of that. Do you think that's the case for a lot of folks?
I'm sure there's a case for some, right? Because, I think there was a CEO, Jassy, that came out and talked about how efficient their employees were doing working from home. I do believe that there are some people. First of all, we're all different, right? We're all different. Me personally, I'm going to do a better job at work around my colleagues. Why? It just is. I need to separate from the house. It's like the treadmill. You feel me? The treadmill in my house does not get used as much as the treadmill in the gym. Mm-hmm. Same with work. I'm not saying I can't work at work. I'm just telling you the work that I do. Well, some will argue the work that I do even at work is not as efficient, but the work at home is even less. So therefore, I personally need to be here. But maybe you are someone that's like, you know what? I don't like people. I don't like you. I actually work better not around folks. There's an argument to be made by that. There's an argument to be really made that really, if you rack them and stack them, when you're in the office, mm-hmm. there's really a lot of, hey, we have a example. We have a meeting this morning at 9 a.m. Cool. So then it's, hey, Charlie, what are you getting ready to do? This is at 8:15. Oh, I got a meeting, Lois, at 9 o'clock. Okay, yeah, I'm getting ready for that meeting. So then you got from 8:15 to 9 o'clock where they're, quote, getting ready for the meeting. So then they get to the meeting. Meeting starts 9 o'clock-ish, maybe 9:15. Meeting goes until 10 o'clock. Then at 10 o'clock, you're after the meeting. Hey, Billy, what have you been doing? Oh, I just left the meeting. So you've been telling people I just left the meeting for another hour. So now we go from 9 o'clock. Now it's 11 o'clock. Now you got an hour to lunch. Hey, George, what are you getting ready to do? Get ready to go to lunch. There's really not that much work going on at work either. You feel me? You're actually probably getting more work done at home. So I could argue all this all down.
I like your approach, though. Something like this, a strike like this, your decision to participate is directly proportional to how essential you think you are to the company.
Come on.
And you're going to find out if you participate just how important you really are. Could be a reality check for some people.
When we had them Cairo meetings here, and we all on the Zoom, on the Microsoft Teams call, and, you know, there's questions, I be hitting Ursula on the side. Hey, Ursula, ask them this, right? Sometimes you just got some coworkers that got more clout than you, right? Or more leverage than you, or they ain't scared to stand up for you. Well, that's Ursula. I'm on the side. I'm on the side like, man, nice. I ain't saying nothing. I cross my T's, dot my I's.
So that's why she's been asking all those questions.
You ever notice that she really does ask all the questions? All right, gotta go.
Seattle's Morning News. Is the state itself responsible for the high cost of housing that's pushing people onto the street? Republican Senator Phil Fortunato finds himself increasingly frustrated that the state isn't making more progress on homelessness. And during the last session, he put into the state budget a housing supply and affordability task force, which would have looked into how to deal with homelessness and try to gather some objective information. But his idea was vetoed by the governor. One reason for that might be that environmental laws, like the Growth Management Act, could turn out to be the cause of the rising price of housing, or at least one of them. Laws like the Growth Management Act deliberately lock away a lot of land. So I asked Fortunato how this has affected, how he feels this has affected, the overall cost of homes in the state.
We touched on the fact that the Growth Management Act drives up the cost of the land. The Growth Management Act also requires the impact fees. So now you've driven up the cost of the land, and then you've added this new home tax, which, by the way, increases the value of existing homes. So that's why everybody else is paying more property tax, all the seniors and all that.
So by how much could you cut the cost of building a home if you got rid of that stuff?
Well, I mean, with the American Dream Home thing, it was $12,500 on the energy credits. Building outside the urban growth boundary was another $50,000 on the cost of the land development. Giving them a property tax break, similar to what they did for multifamily housing for 7 years, that's another $200 and something a month, $200 and $300 a month. So all of that adds up to be $600 to $800 a month in mortgage payment. So
you could cut mortgage payments by $800 a month.
$600 to $800 a month.
And this is the thing that you proposed, to cut these fees so that you could build. And this is for single family homes then.
Right. Now, the parameter that we put on there to appease the Democrats was the Democrats want to keep that home in this, because it was designed for 80% of AMI expense. So it had to qualify to 80% of AMI, which would actually
How much money is that a year?
$70,000 in King County.
So this would be for a home, household making $70,000 a year.
Right.
Could afford a home like this.
Right. And so they want to keep it in that range forever, as opposed to allowing them to get the equity in the house, which is the whole purpose of owning the house, right? So I set a limit. I said, okay, for 7 years, if you kept that house for 7 years and you sold it within that 7-year period, you could only sell it to somebody else who was qualified at that 80% AMI. But if you sold it for 7 years and one day, it now becomes a market rate housing. Mm-hmm. A market rate. So you get whatever the
heck.
So
you can make some money. You can create some wealth.
I mean, and that's how you would be able to step up.
So what happened to that idea?
Well, it actually passed committee.
Mm-hmm.
We got it out of committee. We didn't get a chance to amend it to put some of the other things that we just discussed on. It never came.
So it didn't go anywhere.
Right. So, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop fighting for it.
No, okay. But in other words, you proposed a way of actually reducing substantially the cost of getting a single family home, and they rejected it. All right. So let's talk about the other kind of housing, apartments, right? Smaller units for people who may be single people or elderly people. How can you reduce the price of that kind of housing?
Well, what they've done is they've given them property tax exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
So that would so if you went into an apartment and you qualified for this lower income thing, mm-hmm. your rent would be different than the guy next to you.
Mm-hmm.
Say, because he doesn't qualify for that. So you would actually have a two-tiered rent system based on your income. And so they would get a property tax exemption for 12 years. That allows them to do... Mm-hmm. To
so the developer has an incentive to house low-income people.
Right.
Basically.
Right. But after 12 years, that exemption goes away. And then so that's why you got to keep building more new houses.
Okay. So has that been working?
Yeah. That's actually been good. And as I said, the reason for that is you're getting private enterprise to build these units instead of, you know, low-income housing authorities and stuff.
Was there enough interest in that to actually make a big dent in the homeless population?
I think that is one of the things that in this last session and stuff that has been incentivized. And I think it was we talked about, I can't remember whether we lowered it. We were talking about lowering it to 60% of AMI to be eligible for that lower rents and stuff like that. So that's something. I mean, the ADU deal, accessory dwelling units, being able to have somebody convert, you know, a unit in their property and have a accessory dwelling unit or a mother-in-law apartment that you can maybe rent. And then give them property tax exemptions also if they rented to somebody that was lower income. But remember, these are state, this is, when they subsidize this, it's your money.
Yeah.
You know, so you're in effect subsidizing it. So.
Right. Okay, but at least that works. Yeah, so now
those are some things that in the next couple of years, I think those are some of the things that you're going to see that are going to be affected.
That's good. Okay, so now for the hardcore homeless population, people who are strung out on drugs or who just like the camping lifestyle, have you found anything that works for that group?
Well, hey, you want to live in the bushes, you just can't do it here. You know, you cannot tolerate this stuff. You know, I should have bought the letter that our governor wrote the governor of Idaho about the abortion thing. I don't know if you heard about that, but one of the things that the governor of Idaho says is, we don't tolerate these things on these camps on the side of our road and all that stuff and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years ago, I had a homeless, five bills that were, and these are different, the things we were discussing are still based on those original five bills. The first one was graffiti. And I said, if you tolerate graffiti, you're going to get more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, if you drove through Seattle, you saw a tagging on one of the poles that holds up I-5. Now, hell, they think that any open space is a mural.
I know.
I go, this is ridiculous.
Grow ivy, Phil.
Yeah.
Grow ivy. They hate ivy.
So, but anyway, that's symptomatic. So now, if you accept these homeless camps on the side of the road, I mean, I did a bill called the Welcome to Washington Act, and that was supposed to be to pick up the litter on the side of the road, right? And that's based on you come into Washington from Oregon, there's a big sign, Welcome to Washington, and there's a couch on the side of the road, right? Yeah. So, got that passed. And but nothing's really happened. I tried to do another bill and said, pick up a leaf. You can't pick up the little stuff. How about the big stuff, the big debris on the side of the road? Just pick the big stuff up. And that made it out of the Senate, didn't make it out of the House. But if you tolerate these things on the side of the road, what is the incentive to these people to leave? And the governor said, you know, Senator Wilson and I were going to go camp on the side of the road because the governor made a statement that, if you camp on the side of the road, we'll give you an apartment. Right? So, okay, so all I got to do to get an apartment is camp on the side of the road? You know, you keep reflecting this like this is a housing issue. It's not a housing issue. It's a philosophical issue. You're tolerating these drugs. They want to legalize these drugs, right, as opposed to enforcing some of the drug laws. The best thing you could do for somebody who's strung out on drugs is put them in jail and get their act together.
Republican State Senator Phil Fortunato. Thank you, Phil.
So other than that, I don't really have an opinion. So.
As usual. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.